This is lecture 28. The previous lecture called 26 should have been called 27. We've been talking about constrained systems. And we want to talk now about their quantization. Of course, the quantization of constrained systems was dealt with early on, certainly by 1928 or 29, when people were discussing quantization of the radiation field. But it was only in 1964 that Dirac began a fairly systematic study of the quantization of constrained systems. And I want to review for you rather briefly some of his discussion. We start with the classical theory. We have a Hamiltonian of a number of P's and Q's. We know they should be in Cartesian coordinates when we promote them to operators. So they will become an operator, script H, capital P and capital Q, or the set of P's and Q's that represents. The constraint functions, phi, alpha, P and Q, real functions just like the Hamiltonian was, become operators, Hermitian operators, functions of capital P and capital Q. Indeed, I will be interested in having self-adjoint Hamiltonians and self-adjoint constraint operators as well. These things were zero in the classical theory. We can't literally take them to be zero operators in the quantum theory, so we have to think of something else to do. What does this actually do in the classical theory? It makes a submanifold in the phase space. So here are three axes of the phase space, and I draw a kind of a rug running between it. And this represents the constraint hypersurface where these phis are zero. This is some subset of the original state space, phase space, state space, on which things happen. In quantum theory, our state space is Hilbert space. And we have vectors that belong in that Hilbert space. Each psi, perhaps modulo phase and length, represents a point in the state space of quantum theory, just like a point in the phase space represents a state in the classical theory. So we're looking for a subset of this state space, and that means we're looking for a sub-Hilbert space. We'll call it H sub physical, PHYS physical, that's the physical subspace, and we'll be looking at vectors that belong in that space. They are also elements of the big space, but they are a subset of vectors in the original space. And the idea of Dirac is that the operators of constraint should act on the physical subspace vectors with value zero. So this is the ideal situation. This is then labeling, if you will, determining the subset of the original Hilbert space, which belongs to the physical Hilbert space. And this condition is to be maintained, not only at one moment of time, but for all moments of time as well. Well, this works for some systems. Works for some systems. But there are problems. And let's just talk about two kinds of problems. One is phi alpha of PQ psi physicals equal to zero. This may be a point in the continuous spectrum. And we know that there is no true eigenvalue living, the true eigenfunction living in the Hilbert space that has this eigenvalue zero. These would be idealized vectors like the eigenvectors of the position or momentum operator. So that's one kind of problem. The second kind of problem is consistency. If I have phi alpha on psi should be zero, then the commutator of phi alpha, with phi beta should also act on psi physical to be zero, and this may not follow, may be incorrect. And we'll show you examples of where that happens. So these are two potential problems. May not hold. Two potential problems with this. And it tends to limit the utility of the Dirac prescription to first-class systems. Dirac subsequently talked about a procedure to quantize second-class systems, which we will not go into. But one of the traditional methods for quantizing second-class systems is to solve them classically and eliminate those variables from the problem so that you have a reduced set of variables to start with, and then you quantize the remaining variables. Unfortunately, in doing so, you may have lost your Euclidean space of phase space in which Cartesian coordinates were available, and so the quantization prescription may not be so transparent. All of this is kinematics so far. What about the dynamics? If I'm going to restrict myself to first-class systems are those for which the lambdas, alpha, those are the Lagrange multipliers, were not determined, and you are free to specify them for the particular problem at hand. That's a choice of gauge. And so people would choose what is now called a Dirac gauge, or can choose what is now called a Dirac gauge, in which you just simply set all the lambdas to be identically zero. So our derivatives for equations of motion, Q dot, will be simply Q commutator with the Hamiltonian up to an I. I hope that sign is correct. Since we're doing H bars, we have that. P dot J would be this. And of course, phi dot, one of the constraint operators, is given the same way, I H bar phi alpha commutator with H, and acting on the physical subspace or any vector in the physical subspace, that should also vanish. So we need to have that phi alpha H acting on psi physical subspace. Psi in the physical subspace should be zero to have consistent dynamics so that we stay as a first class system. Let's talk about let's start with an observable. What's an observable in this business? An observable O should act on a vector in the physical subspace, and after it acts on that, it should remain within the physical subspace. Should not take you out of the physical subspace. Observables are typically Hermitian operators, and therefore, if we write our Hilbert space into physical subspace and perpendicular subspace, then our O operator actually breaks into two parts. One which acts on the upstairs, one which acts on the downstairs vectors, but has zero off to the side. So that would have the O acting on a general vector in the Hilbert space with B. So we could call this part the physical part of the operator. You could see how it would take a vector here and not give you a contribution because of the zero down here. So that would make it stay in the physical subspace, stay in the upper part of my breaking up here. But since it's Hermitian, then it has to have a zero down here as well. So that's an important prescription about observables, which we'll encounter as we go along as well. Okay. Now let's do a couple of examples. We'll start with a three-dimensional problem, P vector, Q vector. I'm writing the classical classical action at the moment. Hamiltonian could be P squared plus minus, again, charge over radius. So this could be like our Coulomb problem. And then we're going to put in three Lagrange multipliers, lambda, alpha, with the traditional rotation generators, classical rotation generators, dt. So as we had the last time we got together, we called them something different name last time, but J1 would be y times pz minus z times py plus cyclic permutations. That's my notation for carrying that further for two more efforts. So what we're trying to do is insist that the three rotation generators vanish classically. So we're only looking at spherically symmetric solutions. Okay, what about the quantum theory for this situation? We have capital J vector, and J1 would be defined as capital Y times P sub Z minus capital Z times P sub Y, etc. And they stand to satisfy the standard commutation relations. J1, J2 is I, J3, plus cyclic again. And I'm looking at a physical subspace where all three J's acting on the vectors vanish. Okay, now you know for the Coulomb problem, or you can imagine for the Coulomb problem, that there is the vectors, the eigenvectors labeled by the principal quantum number, the angular momentum, and the magnetic quantum number, Lm. A general vector in the Hilbert space can be written in terms of a superposition of these kinds of eigenvectors. And so this is our general element of the Hilbert space, whereas our physical subspace will be those kind of vectors for which we have n 0, 0, the L equals 0, and consequently the M equals 0, all spherically symmetric situations, and that belongs in our physical Hilbert space. Okay, that's a perfectly possible situation according to the Dirac formulation. And since our Hamiltonian is spherically symmetric, it means that J alpha commutes with the Hamiltonian operator. So our dynamics will stay within this particular subspace. Okay, now let's take a little more complicated example, one that doesn't work so well. Single degree of freedom, P, Q dot. We'll skip the Hamiltonian. We'll have two LaGrange Multipliers, lambda and mu. So what were our classical equations? We vary the p, we get q dot equals lambda. We vary the q, we get p dot equals minus mu. Then we vary the lambda, we get p equals 0. Then we get q equals 0. So since p is equal to 0 and q equal to 0, that means that lambda and mu are both 0. The LaGrange multipliers are determined. Therefore, we're dealing with a second-class system. Second-class system of constraints. What happens when we quantize? We have q is our first constraint, let's call it. And phi 2, our second constraint is p. We can imagine looking for the physical subspace phi, psi phi acted by q should be 0. P on similar vectors, PHYS, physics, physical should be 0. And now we talk about the commutator of these two. So we take Q, commute with P, psi physical. Well, Q commute with P is I times H bar times the identity operator times psi physical. If that's supposed to be 0, since its multipliers are absolutely finite constants, that implies that the psi physical is zero, identity zero, so that means our physical Hilbert space is empty. Not a good solution. So that's one of the reasons this prescription does not work well. I would even say it does not work at all for second class systems. Let's go to a third example.
John?
Yes, question?
Before you move on, in your first example,
yes,
then x squared is observable, but x vector isn't. Is that?
So the question comes from what is observable, yes. So x squared plus y squared plus z squared, or r squared, which will be rotationally invariant, yes, that is observable, but x by itself would not be correct. Okay, our third example will illustrate this first problem. Just like we had before, pq dot minus lambda q, dt is our classical action. That says vary the p, we get q dot equals 0. Vary the q, we get p dot equal minus lambda. And we get q equals 0. So q equals 0 is fine, but p can do anything it likes. Anything it likes. So p is any function. You would have to choose the lambda, choose a gauge in actual fact to find it. So this is a first class system. But when you quantize it, you have a single constraint q. You look for eigenvectors of that with eigenvalue 0 to belong to the physical subspace, and you realize that this is an operator with continuous spectrum, and therefore its eigenvectors, all of them, lie outside of the Hilbert space. So this is going to be a difficult problem to deal with. That did not happen with our J situation. Eigenvectors for the rotation operators, as you know, are all well behaved. They're all square integral functions. They all live in the Hilbert space. Okay. One other example I want to give you for the Mr. Dirac. Again, a single system, pq dot minus lambda. P squared over 2 plus q to the 4th over 4 minus e dt. There's one constraint function, lambda. This is something like we talked about previously in our classical situation, I believe, the last time we were together. This is a first class system here. And the question is, what E values are allowed upon quantization. Okay. Well, our constraint phi becomes quantum theory p squared over 2, capital Q to the fourth over 4 minus E. I ask that that act like zero on the vectors of the physical subspace. So I am looking for vectors p squared over 2 plus q to the fourth over 4 acting on psi physical will equal E times psi physical. The notation has been chosen so that this looks just like an ordinary quantum mechanical problem, Schrödinger problem, and we know that there are a certain set of discrete values, E0, E1, E2, etc., for which this solution has a well-behaved vector. So there are a set of E's, E sub J, if we call it that, for which those E values would be allowed upon quantization. The other E values, for which this is not a vector in the Hilbert space, would not be allowed. And the Dirac prescription enables you to pick out those E values. Okay. I want to pass from the Dirac prescription to a few years later, Fadeyev, 1970, introduced his path integral prescription. I should have emphasized, go back to the word Dirac. We had a Dirac phrase that said, Dirac 1964, put underneath that quantization before reduction. Put that in your notes. What does Dirac do? He quantizes the entire system as if there were no constraints at all. Then he recognizes that the constraints are to be imposed, and that's when he then looks at a subspace in the Hilbert space for which that constraint acting on those vectors will be zero. Fadeyev, on the other hand, goes in the opposite order. He has reduction before quantization. Reduction means to eliminate the redundant part of the space. For example, I've drawn that picture many times of the phase space here, the rug in the phase space. If you immediately go to the constraint hypersurface, then you are reducing first in the classical theory, and then you would try to quantize from that. But of course, you probably lost your Euclidean space, so you cannot have Cartesian coordinates. I believe Dirac sensed that or appreciated that, and that's why he wanted to quantize first when he started in a system in which Cartesian coordinates were available. In any case, this is a prescription of Fadeyev, and it goes for reduction before quantization. Sometimes the two processes commute. Doesn't matter which order you do it. But it isn't always the case, and I want to give you a counterexample to show you that the answer you get if you reduce before quantization is not the same as you get if you quantize before reduction. So then it becomes an issue of which is the preferred way, which is the better way, which is the right way. And that's a debate going on even today. I would vote for the Dirac prescription, quantize first, because I know how to do the quantization there. I know what the Cartesian coordinates are. Okay, what is Mr. Fadeyev's prescription? Fadeyev's prescription starts with a formal path integral. It will actually start and end with a formal path integral. So I have several degrees of freedom. I have PJ, QJ dot, Hamiltonian. Leave space, DT, DP, DQ. The P and Q here represent all the possible P coordinate values and the Q coordinate values. I have my formal constant in front, as usual, to writing down for the formal path integral. The classical action that's here gets augmented by the classical constraints and their Lagrange multipliers. These lambdas are functions of time, and I want to integrate those out so as to enforce the constraints. So Fadeev puts down a curly d lambda. Curly d lambda has the effect of turning this equation into the following equation. If I integrate out the lambdas, I will get a delta functional over the constraints. I'll tell you what that means in just a second, or remind you what it means in just a second. To simplify the notation, I am setting delta of phi, P and Q, equal to the product over our alpha, delta functionals phi, alpha, P and Q. So how many there are, and there are A of them, each one of those is to be satisfied. Well, this by itself is inadequate. Because suppose that phi was like P, some P. If then that P was to be set equal to 0, it would go to 0 in the Hamiltonian, okay, but it would go to 0 here next to the Q dot. And if the Hamiltonian was actually 0, which is a possibility, then when I integrate over that Q, I'm in great trouble. So in the Fadeev prescription, I have to do something else. I have to introduce auxiliary conditions. This is often called gauge fixing. However, gauge fixing to me belongs to the lambdas. And if you're going to use the word gauge fixing when I'm talking about the dynamical variables, then I would like to call it dynamical gauge fixing. Anyway, Fadeev does not call it either of those. He calls it auxiliary conditions, and I think that's a reasonable idea. He introduces some additional quantities, chi super alpha of P and Q, which must be 0. What is the logic behind this? If I have my reduced phase space where I've already eliminated down to where the phi alphas are 0, then it turns out that a given point on here still is not reduced to its physical content, to its minimum physical content. I can talk about gauge equivalent classes of points. So the lines I'm drawing vertically here are all gauge equivalent one with another along those lines. And I draw them only spaced like this just for clarity, but they're every point along here has such a line. So he would recommend that we choose a section through all of these, which is his choice chi, which picks one of the many gauge equivalent points. Here's another one of these many gauge equivalent points. This point here is then the representative chosen of these gauge equivalent points. Okay, so the next step in his calculation is to put those restrictions into the calculation d chi, which very much like this is again a product over this over the capital A number of the separate auxiliary conditions. delta functional, delta functional of phi as well, and then we have dp dq. It's convenient to break up the p's and the q set, of which there are two j. Remember, j was our total number of variables. It's convenient to break it up into two sets. One which belongs to the constraint family. There's a of the phi's, a of the chi's, so that's 2a, and then all the rest, which he calls p star and q star, which there are 2j minus a of those. Now, these are not canonical coordinates, but the hypothesis is that this chi is chosen not parallel to the phi, but quite perpendicular to it. In particular, you want the determinant of the Poisson bracket of the chi alpha with the phi betas to be not zero anyway. For example, if I had chosen simply p equal to zero, one of the p's equal to zero, let's call it p1 here, then it would be natural to take as its auxiliary term q1. And then the Poisson bracket between q1 and p1 is the number 1, which would have a non-vanishing determinant and be quite fine. In this particular case, then, my choice of phi and chi were canonical to each other. Okay, so we're not done yet. We're going to modify that. So I'm not drawing equality signs between these lines. This is the only one with a potential equality sign, except, of course, you pick up lots of 2 pi's when you do this integration. So this is a string of motivated ideas here. So we have a delta of chi, delta of phi. We have our dp star, dp dq star. Those are our freely specifiable variables. And instead of taking the canonical family that would go associated with it, I'm going to take straight away the d phi's and the d chi's as the names of the integration variables. Well, this is very nice. If I integrate the d phi's against the delta phi, that's arranged to be unity. The delta d chi's against the delta chi, that's arranged to be unity. So those guys are straight away out of the problem. But they have done their duty. They have forced certain of the variables to lie on the constraint surface. And in particular, I can now draw an equality, I hope for equality, that this would come down to having p star, where's my star upstairs, q star j dot minus Hamiltonian, a new function, so we call that star, of the p stars and the q stars, dt, dp star dq star. That would be the ideal situation that these guys would just eat up the delta functions, leaving me behind with the physical degrees of freedom. Formally, that means no rigor, no good mathematics, this is okay, an argument. However, of course, there's the implication here, finally, of what is the proper way to make a lattice approximation to make good sense out of that. That's not at all transparent from this, and you've certainly lost your Euclidean structure. That's not the point I want to emphasize. This is a motivation for why I'm doing this here. Now, I want to go back to my original set of coordinates. So those original set of coordinates belong to a set of p's, call them p primes and q primes, which are belong perpendicular to this family. So I want to have a measure which takes from the d chi to the d phi and equates that with the dp primes and the dq primes. And of course, what is needed for that is a determinant of things like d chi dp, d phi dq, d chi dq, d phi dp. And there would be indices here and indices here and indices here like that. But these submatrices here and here actually come together to form the Poisson bracket. Well, I won't write it. I'll do it as a Poisson bracket. Chi with phi. This is the way you would write out the Poisson bracket for that. And if I take the determinant of that with alphas and betas, then that becomes my Jacobian of the transformation back into canonical coordinates. So the next line here would say, need to be I by H bar, PJ, QJ dot, and it's H of PQ, DJ, direct delta functional of chi, determinant of the Poisson bracket of chi with phi. I don't write the indices in particular. Direct delta functional of the constraint functions. And then I have the dp prime, dq prime, along with the dp star, dq star, but that's simply the original family of dps and dqs again. So this is the final formula that Fadeev suggests that we use. These are the constraint functions. I must choose these auxiliary conditions, the chi's, in such a way that the determinant does not vanish. This is the so-called Fadeev pop-off determinant. Fadeev pop-off determinant. If it's a Q and a P, for example, that would be unity. That's a positive number. You would like to keep it positive everywhere. Sometimes, however, it goes to zero. Sometimes it becomes a negative. So those are the Grieboff ambiguities. And I'll be able to illustrate one of those for you in a minute. So this problem is not foolproof.
About four lines above, you say the determinant does not vanish. Or is that just a desirable?
That's desirable. This is the condition that would be desirable. And it turns out for Yang-Mills theories with non-abelian gauge groups, there is actually no choice, which is everywhere, not zero. Okay, so that's a bit of a round trip into efforts to define it, but let's now do some examples with it and see what it does. So our first example, UDI PQ dot minus P squared over 2 minus lambda P minus 1 dG. So P minus 1, P equals 1 is my constraint. I can integrate dP dQ. I have one constraint and I have one pair of canonical variables.
Is the number of phi's and chi's the same?
The number of phi's and chi's is the same. The number of phi's and chi's is the same. So this is alpha equals 1 up to capital A, just like D these guys are Alfie Goodwin of the capital A. And that's also kind of implied or necessary if I'm going to take a square matrix to get it determined. Okay, so here's my d lambda. I integrate that. And I get delta functional of p minus 1 dp dq. That tells me that the p as a function of t is constrained to be unity. That's exactly what the classical constraint wanted it to be. So I can evaluate this. If I'm under the assumption that this is calculating the propagator in the Q representation, then I am propagating starting at time zero from initial point Q prime to final time capital T and a final position Q double prime. If you remember our discussion of that, there was always one more P integral than Q. So be it. Let that happen. We force the P equal to 1. We now evaluate that integral. That's e to the I Q dot dt, and then that P is number 1, so that's minus I by H bar T over 2. And I have a dq left to do. Well, of course, all those q's, the only q this depends on is the final q, q double prime and q single prime, because that's a total derivative. So this is not going to work. I have to put in, as Fadeev would request, my auxiliary condition. So I will choose to say that the q's are zero. Now this is only the q's that are being integrated. There are two q's left over, one for q prime and q double prime. That only makes this integral not infinite any longer. So I get, is my answer, e to the I q double prime minus q prime by h bar minus I over h bar t divided by 2. That becomes my propagator. Be how Fadeev would do the argument. Now the question arises, what about folding? Remember the propagator from 0 to t? I can go from t to capital S up here by integrating over the intermediate times. So if I do that, I integrate k, let's call it q prime 0 dq k to the final time S q at time t, and that should give me the full propagator from q double to s starting from q prime at time 0. Well, in point of fact, this does it in a way. If I multiply those quantities together, e to the I by h bar q double minus q plus I by h bar q minus q prime minus I by h bar t over 2 minus I by h bar t minus s minus t over 2, then they will exactly come out to the function of interest here, except for the integral over the dq. Now either I'm allowed to integrate that by itself and get infinity, or I must recall the fact that I have insisted that I have this auxiliary condition. So if I do that, then I would insert here an extra delta, an ordinary one, delta q should equal to 0. And then this becomes simply the product of this rule. Okay, that is an effort to calculate a modest problem according to Fadeev.
So do we get the same result from
the question is?
Do we get the same result from Dirac's procedure? I mean, quantization after reduction, before reduction.
We can't do it by Dirac. because this operator has continuous spectrum. We haven't learned how to do that. So let us now tackle this middle problem here, still on the board, where we ask the question whether what E values are allowed upon quantization. Let's attack that very problem by Fadeyev's method. So he would say integral e to the I integral p q dot minus lambda p squared over 2 plus q fourth over 4 minus e dt dp dq d lambda. Do the lambda integral. I only have p q dot left upstairs. I have my delta functional p squared over 2 plus q to the fourth over 4 minus e dp dq. Now this is a rather different looking structure. We'll let e be positive so that there are indeed places where this thing has a zero. And then in phase space, P here and Q here, this is some kind of ellipse. It would be an ellipse if there was a 2 here, but this is a distorted ellipse. It looks something like this. So we're actually in a compact hyper-ellipse, whatever to call it, on a region of the phase space at each moment of time. If we introduce the auxiliary condition, we have a choice. Let's choose delta p equals 0. So we're going to insist that the p equals 0. That means we're cutting our hyper-ellipse thing in 2 points. Okay, now we can begin to do the integral. We do the p integral first. That gives me nothing up here and gives me nothing here. Oh, I forgot the Fadeyev Popov determinant. Now that will become a non-trivial interesting factor for us to talk about. This is the Poisson bracket between chi and our phi. And that p will come with that thing, and then that becomes a product at every moment of time of q cubed. So I've done the p integral, and I have product over t, q cubed of point t. Then I have delta functional of q to the fourth over 4 minus e dq left to do. Two ways to look at this integral. In point of fact, this is a integral at each moment of time, and there's no connection with what happens at every separate time. This is just a product over a separate time. So I can either include both points here, this point here and this point over here. This is a region on the right where q is positive, where the Fadeyev Popov determinant is a positive number. On the left, however, q is minus, and q cubed will be minus, so the Fadeyev Popov determinant is minus. That is a Grieboff copy of our original thing. If I include both terms, the positive and the negative, in this integral, since this is an even function, I will get zero. So that's one possibility. I get zero. The second way is to include only one of the terms, the q positive terms. I can do that by changing this formula slightly. And instead of this being product dq as it is all the time, I will say it is product dq 4 divided by 4 and then remove it. Now I have a positive integrand here that's the same thing as that, and I get the number 1 for my integral value independent of e. Totally independent of the numerical value of e. That is to be contrasted with the Dirac prescription in which selected e values were found, those that satisfied this typical looking Schrodinger equation. In the
finite picture, on the other hand, no value of E has been singled out over any other value. So in my opinion, that's a direct example showing that these two methods do not lead to the same result, and I attribute that to the idea of reduction before quantization. And I will go back when we begin next time talking about an improved way, I believe, over both Dirac and over Fadeev, which has goes back to quantization before reduction and uses path integrals for us. Question.